court will call Resnick versus In Contact, 21-4007, and we'll hear from Mr. Patterson.
Thank you. Good afternoon to each of you. My name is Philip Patterson. I represent Victoria Resnick. This appeal places at issue the objective reasonableness of Ms. Resnick's mistaken belief that she had opposed and reported Title VII actionable discrimination, and therefore that she had acquired protected opposition. Ms. Resnick's mistaken belief originates from the employee exemption language within the Title VII statute, which provides that Title VII coverage does not apply to a Title VII employer with respect to its employment of foreign nationals in a foreign company, in a foreign country. So quite clearly, the Filipinos who alleged racial discrimination were without standing, and the court was without subject matter jurisdiction to entertain any of their claims. However, that does not address whether the Resnick possessed the requisite objective reasonableness to challenge that upon which she based her belief.
So, counsel, what did she base her belief on? Is there any evidence in the record that she read the statute or
no?
Independently, no evidence as to that.
No, okay. No evidence that she read the statute. This is strictly. It originates from workplace practice and workplace conduct and communication exchange from Ms. Resnick's perspective, entirely within In Contact Salt Lake City corporate offices.
Can you give me what are the best facts that you have that she was objectively reasonable?
It has to do, okay. Her response was to two Filipinos who had sent to her email transmissions and provided her with telephone conversations in which they alleged a pattern of both severe and pervasive racial harassment by Ms. Resnick's counterpart, second level supervisor. That information was that they had been subjected to racial harassment, that there had been professional treatment received by the gentleman to whom the harassment had been directed. Both employees had requested to be excused from direct supervision by this offending second level supervisor. When Ms. Resnick then brought those emails to the attention of the and she is a ranking, she's not the ranking, but she is an upper-level senior management official. When she brought it to her ranking supervisor, those emails were examined, and the supervisors exclaimed surprise, dismay that those conversations had been uttered, and a second conversation occurred.
Did the supervisor indicate to her that she thought the conversations were unlawful or just abhorrent?
Judge, I would never say that what the supervisor believed or thought.
Well, no. What did the supervisor convey to your client? You said she expressed, some feeling about it. Did she express that, oh, my goodness, that's unlawful. Those are violative of Title VII, we should do something about that? Or did she say that's terrible, we shouldn't ever allow that conduct in this company?
Let's look at the latter. I think what their comments were is this language is like intolerable. It's inexcusable. It should not be occurring in the workplace. And that those sentiments and expressions were expressed a second time with a second group of in-contact personnel, the human resource folks, who likewise observed the same conduct, read the same emails, reviewed the same practices. So there are no target language, or there is no target verbiage articulating Title VII's implications with this subject matter. That was not it. And again, we're at the pleading stage. And
I understand, but now that you bring that up, I mean, wasn't it your burden to plead something to the effect of, you know, some facts showing that she was objectively reasonable for believing that she was reporting a Title VII violation?
Your Honor, I will acknowledge to you that my drafting of that complaint warrants better legal practice than what I displayed.
Well, I appreciate that. I feel that way about some things I've drafted before. So,
well, you know, I can say that about my baseball days, but in any event, but that was not the challenge in either by in contact or in district court. The challenge was not the adequacy of the plausibility of the complaint, but only that because the complaint invoked the employee exemptions language within the Title VII statute, stating that the employment of foreign nationals in a foreign country exempted Title VII coverage. So that was the substance and scope of the district court's ruling. And I know Mr. Moon is here to correct my excesses. However, that would mean also that there was not a further discussion or a further identification other than to say that law substantively and conclusively denied the consideration of this case, warranted its dismissal without complaint amendment, because otherwise, as I would understand Rule 12b-6, I would be given some latitude to amend the complaint.
Did you move to amend?
Did I do what?
Did you move to amend?
No, I did not, because substantively the court had said the employee exemption statute at 1A, Section 1A, it is a conclusive bar to this litigation. Okay. It completely disposes of the claim.
Right. I mean, so based on, I mean, our discussion of your client's actions and investigating whether this was a Title VII violation and what she relied on, you know, office conversations. I mean, it sounds like it would have been futile for you to amend, at least before the district judge, because you didn't have anything to change in your pleading. You had no additional facts.
the judge, my response to that is that the pleading of additional facts would have been immaterial.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Now, do you agree as a matter of law with the district court that if you don't have a reasonable belief that there was a Title VII violation, that you lose?
Yes, that's 10th Circuit case law. I think repeatedly stated. Okay. I agree with that. No and challenge.
So your position is, I know I had to be objectively reasonable, and I didn't have to be right, but I had to be somewhere in the ballpark on when I made this complaint. Is that fair?
Yes. Yes, because what Ms. Resnick is her position is, my objective reasonableness should be directed toward the workplace conduct that was presented to me and which was the object, only sole object, of the discussion between me and my senior management. We did not discuss anything else other than the severity or the pervasiveness of that workplace conduct, misconduct, which they did not challenge to be anything other than misconduct, not to argue that Title VII catchwords were buried in there.
Right, right. No. But the next step is your client having, I mean, I guess your position is, look, we never couched it in terms of Title VII, but now she wants the protection of that statute, even though she arguably didn't pursue the diligence required to receive the protection of the statute.
Judge, that's true, but I believe that, or I would submit to you that 10th Circuit case law and case law that's in that cited in the brief does not require that type of legal sophistication or analytical investigation if the person identifying what she believes to be, or he or she believes to be, actionable discrimination focuses on the offending conduct.
You would agree that in the sexual harassment area, that if she had said, oh, well, I saw this one incident of sexual harassment and turns that in, that would not be reasonable under our cases, because it can't be just a one size incident.
The way I read 10th Circuit case law, Judge, is that that is the general rule, subject to that particular offending conduct being neither severe or. Yeah.
You never got past the point where 2 days later or 2 weeks later, your client was terminated because she didn't fit in.
That's right.
And there could be all sorts of other reasons why they consider that she didn't fit in, which haven't gotten there yet.
We haven't gotten there yet.
All right.
What if, hypothetically, just to segue on to Judge Kelly's question, what if there is widespread sort of anecdotal beliefs that if there is one incident, that could be a hostile work environment? And so she makes a protest, a complaint to the company, and says there was this one incident that somebody made a misogynist or an inappropriate, maybe a racist comment, and so there was a hostile work environment. And now, as you just acknowledged to Judge Kelly, that's not right as a substantive matter, but she's not a lawyer, she didn't know that, and so could that have been the basis for a retaliation claim if there was an adverse employment action that was predicated on her complaining of something that was completely legal. It seems to me that sort of one of the problematic ideas behind this whole theory is the less informed you are, the more the inclined that you are to believe what you read in the newspapers or about what the law is, the greater your protection. The more informed you are, the greater your level of training and experience, the more the less inclined the court will be to say that you have been retaliated against based on a protected activity, that you are more inclined to be unreasonable the more educated you are. The more uninformed you are, the greater the chance that you will succeed. What do you think about that?
I get to answer that just quickly.
Thank you, whatever time you want.
Oh, well, thank you. Judge, the one consideration, Resnick was not identifying a single instance of workplace misconduct. She was identifying a pattern of racial discrimination, a continuing pattern of racial discrimination. Mm. Now, other than that, I think, you know, I don't have really the means to disagree with the plausibility of what you stated. I don't find, you know, major disagreement with it. It's not the fact pattern. I would submit to you only that it's not the fact pattern presented here in this case.
Okay. Thank you. Judge Carson, did you have any questions?
I don't have anything further. Thank you.
Okay. Judge Kelly, do you? Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Baxter. Oh,
thank you, each of you.
Thank you. Mr. Moon?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chris Moon with Jackson Lewis, appearing as counsel for defendant appellee in contact. Now, because this case comes before the court after the grant of a motion to dismiss, the factual record is essentially limited to the 17 paragraphs of factual allegations in Ms. Resnick's complaint in support of a single claim for retaliation under Title VII. Now, ultimately, if this case were to proceed, in contact would strongly reject that it retaliated against Resnick in any way. And in fact, the allegations in the complaint are that the individuals to whom she complained were shocked and dismayed at the allegations and were going to take actions against it. But the question on appeal here is narrow, and it's whether Ms. Resnick's internal complaints qualified as protected activity under Title VII. The district court found that they did not, and that decision should be affirmed. So the factual basis for affirmance is simple. To begin with, Resnick makes factual allegations in paragraphs 9, 11, and 13 of her complaint that the conduct that she complained about were discriminatory comments allegedly made by a fellow manager to, quote, native Filipinos employed by InContact at the company's Manila, Philippines offices. And then Resnick claims that she reported this misconduct internally. Yet Ms. Resnick,
there's no dispute as to that, is there? It's undisputed.
That's right. It's undisputed because it's just part of the complaint.
Yeah.
Yes, that's correct. And Resnick, Ms. Resnick and Mr. Patterson in this oral argument has conceded that the conduct that she complained about did not violate Title VII, and that's because Title VII does not cover foreign citizens who work abroad. Now, Resnick seeks to save her complaint by arguing that she had a good faith belief that she was opposing a practice prohibited by Title VII. Now, while it's true that an employee may ultimately succeed on a retaliation claim, even if a court or jury determines that the underlying claim lacks merit, that doesn't mean that a complaint doesn't have to allege a set of facts that in fact could be a Title VII violation. Now, this court explained in Crumpacker that an employee cannot maintain a Title VII retaliation claim based on an unreasonable good faith belief that the underlying conduct violates Title VII.
Do you agree that we have to consider the objective reasonableness based on her training and experience?
So the court in Crumpacker and then in the following decisions in Clark versus Cache Valley and Held versus Ferrellgas, this court has explained that there's two components to the reasonableness test. And one is a subjective test, and we're not necessarily disputing that Ms. Resnick had an objective, a subjective belief that there'd been a violation of the law. But the second component is measuring that against the substantive law to see whether there has been a Title VII violation. And because these individuals that she was complaining had been discriminated against were foreign citizens working in a foreign country, that puts her complaints outside of the ambit of Title VII.
But it, with regard to the objective reasonableness of her belief, do we consider the level of her training and experience? As I read the Lockheed Martin case, a published 10th Circuit opinion in the Sarbanes-Oxley context, it specifically says that's precisely what we do. We consider for purposes of a retaliation claim, I think, under Sarbanes-Oxley, to evaluate the objective reasonableness based on the aggrieved employee's training and experience. Is that, am I right about that, or am I wrong about that?
Well, I think the Title VII discrimination, I think the Title VII retaliation cases that the parties have discussed in their briefs refer to specifically to analyzing the substantive law to determine the reasonableness of the employee's beliefs. So in that context, I don't think you would necessarily need to evaluate the education of the employee, because you would be evaluating the substantive law and making that evaluation. So as I was explaining, the court in Crumpacker explained that an employee cannot maintain a Title VII retaliation claim based on an unreasonable good faith belief. And that decision in turn relied on the Supreme Court's guidance in Clark County versus Breeden. And in Breeden, the court held that an employee's complaint about a single incident of mild innuendo could not sustain a retaliation claim because no one could reasonably believe that that underlying incident violated Title VII. So combined, Crumpacker and Breeden stand for the proposition that the manner to determine whether an employee has engaged in protected activity is to measure the conduct against the substantive law.
So what would you think about, we're going to assume she's wrong. I mean, she concedes she's wrong, but the different facts would be that the HR department had previously told the employees that they were going to tolerate no discrimination of any type in any of the company's offices, and that if they heard of any discrimination in any company office, that was unlawful and should be reported. What would your position be on her? But the HR department was wrong and she's wrong. What is your position on her objective reasonableness in that fact pattern?
So my position would be that the substantive law would still find that there wasn't a Title VII violation in this case because she was complaining about foreign citizens working in a foreign country. With respect to that specific hypothetical, I think that there...
I agree, though. I mean, she could be wrong, couldn't she, and still be objectively reasonable? I mean, she could ultimately, if she had gone to the books and done some research and just wrongly concluded that it was violative of law, I mean, that would make a difference, wouldn't it?
Well, I think if you go to the books and you take a look at hostile work environment case law, for example, that's the fact pattern in several of the relevant cases, where an individual makes one allegation of a single incident or there's several incidents. So I think on the margins, there's certainly an argument to be made that an individual should be given a little leeway to try to be able to prove her case, especially at the pleading stage. I don't think this case is that, because there's a specific statutory prohibition on the scope of Title VII, and that statutory limit should be applied here to bar the
litigation. Let me follow up on that. If the employee says he thinks there's sexual harassment going on, has a good faith belief, it's not up to him or her to prove that there was sexual harassment going on at all. It's simply a reasonable belief on the part of that person. I mean, Breeden established, or Breeden and the underlying Ninth Circuit case made it pretty clear that whether the person was right or not, there would still go to the reasonableness of the belief.
So to
say that, well, she should have read the statute and known that saying it was employee, you know, abuse is just fine in Manila. Now they haven't gotten to the point that you may come up and say, well, there's 22 other reasons why she was let go, but we've cut it off just because her knowledge of the law was imprecise, and you're saying that she was substantively unreasonable, and that's contrary to all the decisions within the framework of Title VII, where the belief was reasonable, but there was no actual violation.
I think you make a good point, Judge Kelly. I think that what we're saying isn't necessarily that she subjectively believed that she was, we're not disputing that she subjectively believed that she was arguing against conduct that she believed to be unlawful. I think in this case, the decision is even easier because we're measuring that against the substantive law, and we're finding that that's not a Title VII violation. And
well, but the title, the object of the situation is not whether it was right or wrong. It's whether or not she was terminated simply because she claimed that there was what people told her. She passed that on up the line. And did that get her fired?
Certainly. Ultimately, the decision is whether she was terminated in retaliation for engaging in protected activity. The Supreme Court's decision in Breeden is that no reasonable person could believe that the conduct that that person was complaining about violated Title VII, because here is the case law and here are the standards that we evaluate for a hostile work environment. And our argument is similar in that we're saying no one could reasonably believe that Ms. Resnick was complaining about a Title VII violation, because here is the statute, and the statute says that you cannot have a Title VII violation for a foreign employee working in a foreign country. And her complaint concedes that that's exactly what she was complaining about.
Now, that's the 11th Circuit approach. Absolute.
Well, I think that's the 11th Circuit's approach. And I think that that's also the approach here. That's also the approach in the 7th Circuit, the 2nd Circuit. And I think that that would be the approach here in the 10th Circuit based on the decision in Crumpacker and then the unpublished decisions in Clark versus Cache Valley and Held versus Ferrellgas. So Ms. Resnick, moving on, Ms. Resnick argues that the standard that should be enforced should not require legal sophistication or legal investigation of her claims. And we would argue that she errs when she argues that the reasonableness standard should give due allowance to the limited knowledge of mm-hmm. most plaintiffs about the factual and legal basis for their claims. That standard should be rejected for at least four reasons. First, that is not the 10th Circuit standard. Resnick points to Moyo versus Gomez, the Ninth Circuit decision from 1994. Moyo is not the standard in the 10th Circuit. Instead, the 10th Circuit does not allow for a plaintiff's limited legal knowledge to bolster meritless retaliation claims. To the contrary, this court requires district courts to examine the underlying conduct under the substantive law. Now, second, Moyo's lenient standard conflicts with the Supreme Court's guidance in Breeden, which postdates Moyo, and then this court's decisions, which I previously cited. Moyo also makes no sense as a matter of policy. Judge Bacharach had pointed out that applying a standard that gave due deference for ignorance of the law would seem to reward ignorance instead of instead of actual knowledge of the law.
Let me ask you a question, and I think you raise a good point about the policy considerations, but I'm still struggling a little bit, and I don't want to beat this into the ground, but you distinguish Lockheed Martin based on the fact that it wasn't Title VII, and that Title VII cases say that you evaluate objective reasonableness based on the law. The unspoken implication is that there's some dichotomy between considering both the underlying law and the training and experience. But why would it matter that there was a retaliation claim under Sarbanes-Oxley in Lockheed Martin as opposed to a Title VII claim? Why would the definition of the objective reasonableness for determining whether something is a protected activity, why would it matter? Why would it be distinguishable that one scenario involves Sarbanes-Oxley and the other involves Title VII? After all, there's not a Title VII case that says that you don't apply Lockheed Martin in Title VII cases or that you don't consider training and experience.
No, and I wasn't suggesting that there needs to necessarily be a dichotomy merely because one statute is because I understand what you're saying, which is that the retaliation standards on Sarbanes-Oxley and Title VII are by and large the same. What my point was simply that regardless of whether it's coming up under Sarbanes-Oxley, and I think that that would be a fact-intensive inquiry, but you would still need to measure that against the substantive law of Sarbanes-Oxley to see whether there had been a violation, whether that would be reasonable to argue that there was a violation in that circumstance. Thank you, Your Honors. If there are no further questions, I'll end my time now. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Melissa, does Mr. Patterson have any time?
No, he was over by a minute and 37 seconds.
Okay. I ate it all up.
Well, I think we ate a lot of everybody's time up. So this matter is submitted.